Good morning and welcome to Smashy Business. I'm Lubna Hamdan.
And I am Ali Baba.
Ali Baba is casual today.
Very.
but I love the casual look, Ali, because you know, we're going to be talking about sports later on. So, and you're dressed to the nines when it comes to sports. Mm. But first of all, to quickly go through the news, Piers Morgan is moving his uncensored show from Talk TV to YouTube. Saudi Aramco has paid dividends despite a 25% fall in profits. And another Saudi story, which Ali, you're going to be giving your input on. Saudi is going to privatize football clubs, and there are talks Cristiano Ronaldo is considering buying a local club. And then forgive me for talking about this during Ramadan, but alas, the news and the show must go on. So our guest today will be talking strip clubs, dropping out of university, and the fad of entrepreneurship and podcasts coming up next. Welcome, Ali, to the show. How's it going?
Great.
Ramadan Kareem.
Ramadan Kareem.
Dropped a bomb on you right there, didn't I?
Yeah. Ramadan and strip clubs, they perfectly go
hand. Going hand in hand. No pun intended, of course. Yeah. We're getting canceled today. Are you into watches, Ali?
Watches, yeah.
Yeah, what's your favorite watch brand? Your dream watch brand, let's say. Rolex, AP, Patek
no, no,
Philippe.
No, not that high. I don't think
not that high.
No. A good Versace, Agner, you know, those kind of watches are fine. I'm fine with.
Okay.
They're nice. Yeah.
Okay. I have on my hand a watch that does not belong to me. Borrowed it from a friend to talk about it on the show. It's the rose gold AP Offshore. I'm going to show it here to the camera, to my camera. What do you think? How much do you think this costs?
Looks expensive.
Mm-hmm. It's about 250,000 dirhams. I'll get you that number in USD, which is about $68,000. That's the retail price, of course, because there's a there isn't as much supply. That could easily double, but that is the retail price. And it's interesting because the collector that owns this watch, and I did a segment about watches once, and they're quite interesting because they're the new investment kind of stream for a lot of people. Buy these watches, keep them, wait for the price to go up, and then sell them. And it's quite interesting. But he told me that the most well-known watch, I guess, for AP is the Royal Oak. But he told me that, you know how they say people who can't afford a Ferrari buy a Maserati? This is the same thing, apparently. I'm not going to pretend like I'm a watch guru. Apparently, people who can't afford the AP Offshore buy the Royal Oak. I can't afford either, guys.
Same here.
Yeah, chatting about it. Our producer, one of our producers, Ali, just said in my earpiece, he wears a Casio that's 30 dirhams.
That's great.
Ali, there's no shame in the Casio game. I'll say that. So, right, let's go down to the news. Piers Morgan, do you like him? Are you a fan of his?
He's very controversial. Sometimes I like him, sometimes I don't.
I think his fall from grace was when the... when the genocide first started in Gaza, and he kept asking the same question over and over again.
You condemn Hamas.
Yes, exactly. And I think that was his fall from grace because, as we all know, he really made a stance to be remembered during the Iraq war, and he was fired from his job at the Mir at the time.
Yeah.
So I don't know what he did there. I read an article in the FT today that he is... the article says Piers Morgan's change of program hits Rupert Murdoch's TV dream. So Piers Morgan said his Daily Show had become an unnecessary straitjacket because it's running on Talk TV's channel instead of just on YouTube. From next week, he's going to host it on YouTube channels owned by News UK, which is a subsidiary of the Murdoch family's News Corp. It's the most watched show on the channel since it launched 2 years ago. He reportedly struck a three-year deal, allegedly worth $64 million. Oof, how nice is that? Let's manifest that one day, Alibaba, that we'll get a deal like that. Hint, hint,
just give me
Richard.
10% of that.
But even with his power to attract celebrities and politicians, the article says the TV channel only managed to achieve average viewer numbers of just over 50,000 last year. That's pretty low for Piers Morgan, but it's TV we're talking about.
Yeah.
And now that Murdoch's son took over, has been taking over management, they're going through to the other direction. You're also a producer.
Yes.
You know your stuff when it comes to digital. We spoke about Shark Tank just the other day, saying that it should have been on one of the streaming platforms. We saw Tucker Carlson interview Putin. Since he left Fox News, viewership has skyrocketed on his channels. He's doing much better than he ever did with those TV channels. Is it over for TV?
Yes, 100%. Like you have, like I can tell you about sports journalists where they went independent. Like Fabrizio Romano, he was part of Sky, Italy, and after when he went independent, skyrocketed. Nobody knew like. The scene, the football scene knew who he was.
Right.
But after Sky Italy, he blew up completely.
Right.
Like he came up with the Here We Go and everything. So social media was a big game for him. Yeah, like these like big time journalists and TV stations can hold their own on outside.
You know, I think after what happened with Iraq and Piers Morgan's stance on that, and after he was kind of screwed over for that, fired from his job, I think his ego really took a massive hit, because I think had he done, and perhaps, and maybe he will do what Tucker Carlson did after Fox News, had he, or maybe he should do that right now with Talk TV, because, you know, does he really need them? I don't know. We'll see. It's an interesting take. Let's talk briefly before we move on to Saudi Aramco. A brilliant story. But let's talk briefly about Shark Tank. Do you think that they'll put it on any of the streaming platforms? Because when I went to their YouTube account and I've watched a couple of episodes, I mean, all of the comments, one guy said something that was very accurate. He said, "I came here because everyone said Shark Tank Egypt is better. And I'm in the comment section to confirm, yes, it is." Brilliant. Ouch, but
ouch.
Brilliant.
That's harsh criticism, but, you know, you take it.
Yeah.
You take it.
If you take it on the chin.
Yeah, if you're doing Shark Tank Dubai or UAE, you know.
Yeah.
You have to make sure that, you know, you take criticism like that and you move forward. And don't put it on social media.
Exactly.
You know, stream it, please.
Stream it, please. Yeah. We want to watch it, so
promote
please stream it.
Promote it, market it, you know? It's not been done properly.
You know, some of the criticism that we got, and we take criticism well.
Yeah.
I think we do, don't we?
Do.
As Arabs and Russians, we take criticism very well, as we've seen from, you know, in history, politically, and everything. Exactly. Don't push it too much.
Don't push it.
But so one of the criticisms in the comments under our reel, which has nearly 500,000 views, bring it up here.
And we did it.
We did it. We're going to go viral. It's our 5 minutes of fame.
We're famous now.
But one of the comments was, why are you criticizing that the show is in Arabic? Because we're in an Arab country.
Yeah.
But Dubai is mainly English speaking.
Yes.
So surely it should have been in English, the show, right? It's not a crazy, mind-blowing idea, is it?
No. It would have made sense.
I mean, if this were to happen in Bahrain, it would have to be
Arabic. 100%.
But Dubai is an exception. So it does really not make sense for it to be in Arabic.
Yeah. And that's also the main reason why Biban is in Arabic.
Exactly. Biban, by the way, is the Bahraini Shark Tank inspired show, I would say.
Yeah.
That's great. Are you still watching it?
No.
Okay. Moving on. Saudi Aramco. Has paid dividends despite a 25% fall in profits. Just a quick clarification for people who don't know this. The dividend payout is, dividends. Okay, let me go through the news. Excuse me, guys. Quick quick morning here. Saudi state-owned oil company, of course, Saudi Aramco, announced a net profit of $121 billion for last year. It was lower than 2022, thanks to a drop in oil prices and lower sales. But the company still paid dividends of nearly $100 billion. Don't you wish you were a shareholder right now hearing that number?
Cool.
Dividends to shareholders rose by 30%, in fact, in 2023. To clarify to our listeners, this is exactly what I wanted to say. Dividends are distributions of profits. They're not normally paid if the company is experiencing losses because it could jeopardize liquidity of a company. But despite the drop in profits for Aramco, the figure was still the second highest reported by the company after its record $161.1 billion in 2022, which was the largest profit recorded by an oil or gas company. The dividend payout is likely to anger campaigners who have condemned the huge profits made by energy companies, and the bonus is handed to executives. But alas, everyone loves to criticize the Middle East and tell them what to do.
It's been the case since 1970-something.
Indeed. Yeah. But you know what? It was still the largest profit last year, in 2022, sorry, recorded by an oil company.
Mm.
So I think they're doing just fine.
Yeah, they're fine.
I don't think anything is jeopardized. I think they're starting to love being criticized. You know, let the Westerners' blood boil.
Yeah, I think it's their source of entertainment now.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. What a great addition you are to the show, Alibaba. So entertaining. Right, moving on to your area of
expertise. Yes.
Saudi Arabia is privatizing its football clubs.
Mm.
It's a massive opportunity for global investors. This means, of course, that the Saudi League is now open to private equity companies mm-hmm. and foreign investors. It aims to make investments sustainable and profitable, expand the global broadcast reach, become a magnet for global stars, and much more. The Saudi League has already sold rights to 12 networks across 130 countries for the 2023 and 2024 season. According to insiders, there's also talk of Cristiano Ronaldo considering buying a Saudi club.
Mm-hmm.
This is all, of course, the privatization of the football clubs in line with the Saudi Vision 2030 to diversify the post-oil economy. And doing this through sports is one aspect of the economic diversification.
Mm-hmm.
Cristiano Ronaldo, will he buy a Saudi club, you think?
Now, him buying a club, I think it's a good business decision to buy a club in Saudi Arabia.
Mm.
Because they're moving how the Premier League moved back then, where they opened the, like, they made it public for people to buy the clubs.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So they're having a
I'm going to pretend like I knew that. That's why you're on the show. That's why you're on the show. Every day is a school day.
So just see, for everywhere in the world, the Premier League is the complete guide to how to be how to have a successful league.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. it's the most successful league in the world, and they make a lot of money, a lot of money.
Right.
So Saudi wants to reach that stage. How can we have the best league in the world, and how do you approach it? Okay, first you look at the clubs. Okay, you see four clubs are owned by the Saudi investment
PIF.
Yep,
that yes. one.
The rest of the clubs, they were shocked and like, okay, so these guys have unlimited money, and we have very, very limited money. What do we do?
Yeah.
Where do we get our players from? You
right.
know.
Mm.
This is their answer. You know, people will buy you. And billionaires, millionaires,
right?
You know, and
brilliant move, because we were talking about this just last week.
Yeah.
What is Saudi going to do next when yeah. it comes to football and sports, and yeah. how will it attract a more global audience? Yeah. What a move!
Yeah, you'll get players now coming from, already players are coming from all over the world, but younger and more talented players would be more keen to go to Saudi Arabia, especially within the Gulf region. they'll try to aim to get into the Saudi Arabian League, similar to how the UK is. It's one country, but like you have Ireland and Scotland, and you know,
right, right.
So you have the Scots trying to get in, you know.
Yeah.
It's sort of the same thing. You can think of Bahrainis trying to get into the Saudi Arabian League, Emiratis and Qataris, right, and so on and so forth.
Exciting stuff, yeah. Ali. Thank you for being on the show.
No problem.
Always a pleasure. Mm. Always. Up next, and speaking of players, is he a player? Is he an entrepreneur? Is he a podcaster? What exactly does he do? We'll find out next with Matt Haycox. Stay tuned. From strip clubs to entrepreneurship and lending and borrowing money, Matt Haycox with us here in the studio today.
Quite a journey.
Quite a journey. Walk me through it. So you decided to drop out of university. So many people do that. It's become kind of an entrepreneurship fad, if you will. Why did you do that?
So I went for 6 weeks. I never wanted to go at the time, but it was very different back then to now. I mean, I don't want to give away my age, but I mean, you know, in the kind of late 90s, to not go to uni was a very big deal, particularly if you'd already been through private education. I think it was very much the kind of done thing. I think it was almost like a disappointment to parents if you had kind of gone to private education, because then it was like, well, why have you done it? You know, what was the point in us paying for your education to 18 for you to then not go to uni? Because right. Also, you know, I mean, particularly all the big corporates, but most decent employers in the, you know, in the kind of mid to late 90s, if you didn't have a university degree, they were not hiring you.
Mm-hmm.
But I was always adamant that I was going to go and run my own business and work on my own. So for me, going to uni just felt like I'd be holding myself back another 3 years.
I completely understand, because I went to the American University in Dubai here, and I can confidently say that I learned absolutely nothing. In fact, I was told not to think outside of the box and to wait until I graduate to think outside of the box. You took over your dad's business, though. It's not just like you dropped out or you decided to open a business. You took over the business.
Yes, I mean, so it wasn't exactly my dad's. It was another family's family business that okay. had been around for many years. It started to fail. My dad, he just sold his business. He was in IT, and he invested in this business. I went there initially to work in sales, but the business was falling to pieces, and my dad had, you know, he just didn't want to work in it. He always used to say, I'd come home from work every night, because I was still living at home at the time, and I'd be like, Dad, come on, you know, these guys are ruining the business and they're running off with your money.
Right.
And he just always used to say, oh, I've had 25 years of business and 30 years of your mother. I'm, you know, I don't need any more stress. And I think eventually he kind of gave in and said, oh, you know, you can't make it any worse than they're making it, so
right.
go do what you want to do. And then I kind of went in the next day, fired everybody, and started from scratch. And it was, you know, it was 3 years of the biggest learning curve that I could possibly have asked for. Obviously, a lot more than I would have ever gotten from university. Not that I knew what I was doing. I mean, I thought I knew what I was doing,
mm-hmm.
But kind of, I guess, kind of learned what to do by either making mistakes myself or watching the mistakes that everybody else had made along the way. And I did that for 3 years. We went from a £300,000 loss to a £30,000 profit, which it was never that it was big numbers. You know, even back in those days, it wasn't huge numbers.
Right.
But it was more the principle of, you know, of being able to enact that turnaround and learn all the things that I needed to learn.
Mm-hmm. Well,
at the time, I always used to say I've learned everything there mm-hmm. is to learn about business. And mm-hmm. then when I went on to the next business, learned pretty quickly that I had barely scratched the surface.
Really interesting. We're going to get to the strip clubs. What a topic to open with, what a guest to open with today, the first day of Ramadan. We're going to keep it respectful, but we're going to talk about that side of the business, because business is business at the end of the day. But tell me a little bit about, I want to get your opinion, because a lot of people do drop out of school wanting to become the next Jeff Bezos, Steve Jobs, etc. What do you think of that? It's become a bit of a fad, a bit of a trend.
What, to want to be an entrepreneur?
To you know, drop out of university and want to become an entrepreneur. You actually did that. Do you think a lot of young people today do that, but are maybe too privileged and kind of miss out on the point of, you know, actually hustling. They take their dad's money, they open a business, it shuts down a few months later.
I mean, look, I think whether you go to university or whether you learn from different methods, you know, people, I believe, always miss how difficult it is to start, operate, and ultimately make successful a business. You know, I think because the barrier to entry in business is so low, I mean, anybody can set up a business tomorrow, or, you know, whether that's because they create the LLC or whether that's because they've bought a product or, you know, or got something they want to sell. It's very easy to become an entrepreneur and, you know, write entrepreneur on your Instagram profile. But the analogy I always use is, you know, if you compare it to, let's say, professional sports, no one would possibly pick up a football today for the first time ever and decide that they can play on the same field with David Beckham. But with, you know, there's a very clear league, there's a very clear, you know, set of skills and effort and time that needs to go into it from, you know, the first time you pick up the ball to the time that you consider yourself a professional footballer. And, you know, these professional, I guess, the professional business owners are the billionaires, the multi-millionaires, and there's a very clear, you know, set of skills, timeline, you know, effort process that needs to go into it. But because it's just very easy to say, I'm an entrepreneur, I own a business, I think, you know, people miss all the hard work that needs to go into it. And that's ultimately probably why there's so many failed businesses.
Absolutely. You're a dad now. How old is your son?
Well, it's a daughter. I've got two. I've got a 17-year-old and a 10-month-old.
Right, two daughters.
Yeah.
Okay, bless them. I mean, daughters are just so much easier to deal with, kind of, right? A little bit.
You know, when I had my first one, I was always wanted a boy. I was convinced I was having a boy, and it was going to be my little mini me.
So, how Arab of you?
Pardon?
How Arab of you?
But when I got the girl, now I couldn't imagine having a boy.
So, right. That's beautiful. If they wanted to drop out of school. Or not go to university, for example, would you back up their decision?
I would back their decision based on what it is that they want to achieve. And ultimately, I want everybody to be successful. For me, my definition of success, you know, is two things really. One is that you're happy, because, you know, whether you've got money or whether you've, you know, you've become a professional, whatever it is you wanted to become, if you're not happy when you're doing it, then for me, you've failed. And also, you know, being successful for me is very personal to you. You know, what have you decided you want to do, and can you achieve that? So for me, they're the two key metrics. But there's many, many ways to get there, you know, whether that's through university. So my elder daughter, you know, she wants to work in engineering at the moment. You know, she wants to do something with aerospace and that kind of thing. I mean, she absolutely really has to go to university. I mean, okay, maybe there's some apprenticeship type thing she can do.
Right.
But if she wants to do it fast, if she wants to get the credible jobs, then she's going to have to go to university. But, you know, obviously at 10 months old, I don't know what the next one's going to be up to.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just want them to follow the right path and the quickest path, and not do what, you know, people feel that they put pressure on other people to do.
Absolutely. What exactly are you doing now, Matt? Because you do a number of things, consulting, I believe, podcasting. Tell me a little bit about exactly what you do.
So my core business is lending money to other small businesses back in the UK. I mean, I moved to Dubai 3 and a bit years ago now, just purely accidentally and for lifestyle choices. But all my business is still back in the UK. We do have an office here, but all the businesses that we lend to are back in the UK. So my core business is financing other small businesses, bringing them both capital, but also bringing them advice. And, you know, I always say that I learned to be a lender by being a borrower. And, you know, when I built the strip clubs, when I built all the other businesses I built during the kind of early 2000s and late 2000s, I did it with borrowed money. And at the time, you know, I didn't even really know what borrowing money was all about. And, you know, it was something I learned to do. And I say learned because I very much believe that borrowing money is a skill set. You know, it's something that business owners need to learn if they're going to grow those businesses.
Absolutely.
But a lot of the time, people just want money because they're using it to mask a problem, you know, to borrow money to fill a black hole because they haven't been able to fix the fundamentals of the business. You know, they haven't been able to trade right, market right, make enough money. So we don't just bring money, we bring the business support, the business advice. And you know, I always say to my clients that I've had, you know, 25 years of business problems and mistakes and failures, and I've kind of done them so that either you don't have to, or that I can give you first-hand advice that other lenders or other banks and institutions can't give. So it's a hybrid, really, of, you know, of lending money, of investing, of providing support, of consulting. So that's the day-to-day. You mentioned the podcast. I have a podcast as well, which again, like moving to Dubai and like so many of my other things, was an accident. You started it probably in 5 years ago now. I think we're on episode 300 and something. It was done just really to make some content, you know, so I could build my online presence. So I kind of started a podcast just to, you know, just to make some videos, to make some audio. But now I always say that I think everybody should have a podcast. For me, it's been one of the great, I guess, tools and fun things for me. You know, it gives me a great chance to meet people I wouldn't normally meet.
Right.
It gives me a great chance to sit down and ask people questions that are of total benefit to me. And then obviously it's good for building my profile and bringing in new business as well.
Lending money, you're doing that back home. Would you consider doing that here?
I'll never say never, but what I do always say is that, you know, I've spent 20 odd years learning the English markets and knowing all the intricacies of what could go wrong and what does go wrong. And, you know, money's very easy to lend and very difficult to collect. And, you know, each country has their own rules, each legal system has their own kind of nuances. And, you know, I always say I've not got enough money to do all the deals I need to do back in England. Never mind move to another country and do it. So at the minute, look, we raise a lot of money here in the UAE. There's a lot of investors here who are looking for high returns, you know, who like England, who like the English legal system and lending money. But right now, I'm not ready to lend over here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Borrowing money is an art.
Yes.
And as you said, it's very intricate as well. But what not to do when borrowing money?
Well, I think one of the most important things not to do is not to borrow money that you don't need to borrow. I mean, so many times I see business plans, you know, whether that's startup businesses or more established businesses, looking to borrow money to pay for things that they shouldn't be buying in the first place.
Absolutely.
You know, whether that's fancy offices when they don't need them, or whether it's hiring staff when the existing staff aren't delivering enough. You know, so many different answers for so many different businesses. But, you know, more often than not, people can either get away with borrowing less or get away with borrowing nothing if they knew how to run the business better in the first place.
Fascinating that you mentioned that, because I remember when Karim opened here in Dubai, they were the two co-founders, or three co-founders, sorry, and they were the ones taking the customer service calls. They would sleep on the couch, take the customer service calls. But then they decided to open an office, I believe, in Media City, where the rents are, you know, pretty high, I would say, higher at least than TCOM and or Bersha Heights and other places, or Production City, for example. And that's one of the costs, right? Entrepreneurs do tend to burn investor money, especially here in the region. We spoke to Fadi Ghandour at the Qatar Web Summit a couple of weeks back, and he said there's no longer free money here in the region. The funding is stabilizing now. It's dropped a little bit. There's no more free money. But speaking of money, so that was a very interesting point. Thank you for that. But speaking of money, the strip clubs, I mean, we see it in the movies, but I've never actually met someone who has opened and owned strip clubs. How did that come about? You said you wanted to meet girls.
Well, that was how I kind of got into the leisure business in general, really, more than just the strip clubs. But I, you know, when I left the uniform business, I wanted to open some bars and clubs.
You said no more uniforms.
Certainly no more uniforms. I was very bored with that, and I was 21, 22 at the time. I think, you know, every 21, 22-year-old guy thinks I can own a bar, I can, you know, drink beer, I can meet girls, and I can make money all at the same time. And I found out very quickly it wasn't quite that easy. But I knew a bit about the strip club business and the strip club model just from spending time in the local clubs myself back in Leeds. And when my bars weren't performing well enough, because I knew I needed higher margins, I needed other forms of income than just selling the alcohol alone, I decided that you know, taking the best bits of the strip club model and bringing it to my business was the way forward. So I poached a local manager from the club that I knew, and we went off to go and find a club.
And you were 21?
No, well, by the time I opened that, I was 23. 23. So I'd done about 2 years of doing normal bars and clubs, and I opened the first strip club in March 2004. So yeah, 23.
Interesting. And you bootstrapped that, or you borrowed money, or how did that work? And how did the manager take you seriously at 23 years old to open a strip club?
That's a good question. I've never been asked that before. He was, I guess I knew him well. He was a guy who'd become a bit of a friend, and I guess he trusted me. He probably also felt he wasn't giving up the best job in the world. That if he came to me and it didn't work out with me, he had nothing to go back to. So I think he was probably a bit dissatisfied with his old employers, and he liked my ideas of what I was willing to bring to the business and bring to the table. That's question number two. Question number one was I did it with a combination of borrowing some money, some bootstrapping, and begging and borrowing from my builders and from my other suppliers to help us get to opening day, because yeah, once we'd started the build, we ran out of money very quickly, and I had a lot of uncomfortable conversations and begging days with people saying, please, you know, if you walk away from me now, we're all in a pickle, but if we get through this in 8 to 10 weeks, there'll be plenty of money to go around for everybody. And we opened, and luckily there was plenty of money to go around for everybody.
And then when did you decide to, did you sell the strip clubs? How many did you own?
I opened the first one in March 2004. About 6 months later, I bought a failing club, failing strip club in another local town to me. And then over the next 4 years, ultimately became the biggest strip club operator in the UK. I had 11 venues trading, from the kind of north of England to the south of England. But also at the same time, because I'd learnt to borrow money, as I said earlier, I kind of used that to just grow my businesses in general. So I had normal bars, you know, non-strip club bars and pubs, I had restaurants, I had shops, I had hotels, property developments, all kinds of different businesses. But then in 2008, when the credit crunch started, I learned very quickly that I was over leveraged, undercapitalized, and didn't know as much as I thought I knew, and it all fell down pretty quickly. And in the space of about 8 weeks, lost a lot, and woke up bankrupt in September 2009.
Wow, I'm gonna get to that. Wow, but who's the most interesting person to have ever walked into one of your strip clubs? Any interesting personalities?
We'd have a few football players. We had the odd celebrity that came in. But I guess for me, what was probably more interesting was not the famous people that came in there. It was just that I got to meet lots of great people in there. And you know, one of the things I always talk about is networking and the importance of building your network and having that kind of a power network around you for whatever it is you want to do. Now back in those days, I certainly wasn't as thoughtful and proactive about it, but they were fantastic venues to meet people in, because you know, whether or not they admit it, all the local wealthy business owners would be in there.
Right.
People
let their guards down there as well.
Well, also as the owner of anything, as the organizer of anything, the promoter of something, you know, you get a level of access and a level of respect that other people don't get. So you know, being that owner, gave me a kind of a foot into their world, and I made some great connections back in those days that you know still last with me today.
The casinos are coming to the UAE. They're starting in Ras Al Khaimah. There are rumors they're opening in Dubai as well. Are you going to be involved in that in any way?
No, I'm sure I'll be a customer. I do love a game of poker and a game of blackjack, but no, it's not a business I've ever operated in.
Do you have any thoughts on it? Any opinions of how it's going to affect the UAE? Some people are happy about it. Some people are heavily criticizing it.
You know, I don't know many businesses that come to an area that don't do anything other than something positive. Mm. I think, you know, normally when people are talking about the negative effects of a business, it's it's from a personal perspective of wanting to, you know, wanting to get some airtime to, you know, to promote their political cause, or just, you know, just because they want to have themselves heard. I mean, we used to have the same thing with the strip club business all the time. There'd always be a local councillor, you know, a local politician who wanted to talk about how the strip club business ruined cities and promoted abuse to women and stuff. Claims that could never, ever, ever be backed up, and ultimately just, you know, simply weren't true. But I think, you know, for me, anything that brings anything that's legal, anything that's ethical, that brings money to a, you know, to an economy is a good thing.
Right. It's interesting because some people do think that the casinos will quote unquote ruin parts of Dubai, and that they're going to attract, you know, negative, unwanted, unneeded attention. You don't think that will happen?
I mean, I think there's always going to be bad elements of people in anything, but ultimately, you know, those people will always find a way to do what they want to do, and I think to have controlled, regulated, you know, methods of anything is always the right thing to do. You know, if you don't have legalized and I guess organized casinos, then people will find a way to, you know, the people who are the real problem people will find a way to gamble anyway. You know, if you don't have the strip clubs legally back in the UK, then people probably, you know, slip into more underworld prostitution and that kind of thing. So I think to bring anything to the forefront, you know, to control it, to put a set of rules around it, is always the right thing, because there's always going to be bad actors in every game.
I mean, hey, we already heard about the, you know, Dubai shutting down a couple of illegal casinos anyways, that people have been operating from apartments, penthouses, so they're already there. So great point. Matt, how did you come back from bankruptcy?
I always say that I don't have an exciting story to tell, because I think, you know, normally people want these kind of general, you know, general speaking to his troops, you know, call to arms. But ultimately, I woke up bankrupt. I had a baby that was 1 year old at the time. I had an ex-wife, you know, who needed a roof over her head. And I always said I was never born to be poor. And I just had two choices. I could sit at home. I could, you know, watch TV and complain how I was a victim and that, you know, everything went wrong around me. Or I could get on with it and get back out to work again. And, you know, something I didn't really appreciate at the time, but I understand a lot more now, is people used to say to me, oh, you know, what was it like to lose everything? And, you know, what I've very much realized in my later years is that I didn't lose everything at all. I actually only lost money. Other than that, I didn't lose anything else. You know, I didn't lose my network. I didn't lose my skill set. I didn't lose my experience. And if anything, I came out of it with more experience, because I just experienced, you know, the situation of bankruptcy. It might not have been a great experience, but it was certainly something that was a learning curve. So I went back to work the next day. Initially as a finance broker, because again, I had that skill set of how to borrow money. I knew a lot of lenders who wanted to lend money, and I knew a lot of people in my local area who wanted to borrow money but didn't really know how to go about it, or outside of the mainstream institutions didn't know where to go and get it. So I went out effectively making a commission, charging a fee to consult and broker for those people. But second time around, I made my money back a lot quicker than I made it the first time, just because, you know, like I say, the only thing I lost was the money. I had the experience, I had the grounding, and I knew what to do. Yes, it was, you know, looking back, people say, oh, well, you know, what would you have done differently? And I don't even know if I would, to be honest. You know, I think it's such a hypothetical question. And I guess being bankrupt back in those days gave me the experience and knowledge which has led to where I am today. You know, I'm happy with how it played out.
Fascinating. It's such a fascinating story. Sorry, my producer just whispered in my ear, said, Lubna, change your facial expression. I'm often told to smile more.
I'll try and be funnier.
caught me off guard. I was really tuned into the conversation and he just caught me off guard. Does anyone ever tell you as a man to smile more often?
No, maybe to be more serious.
No, to be more serious. Yeah. what a story, Matt. It's really, I mean, interesting to say the least. And again, never in my life have I met anyone who owned strip clubs. It's very exciting, even more exciting that you did come back from bankruptcy. How's the business looking right now? any new projects? You owned pubs and restaurants back in the UK. Did you ever think about opening something here?
I mean, again, so two answers. The second answer first, just for me, I've got enough on in the UK to not want to do anything new here right now. Like I said, we do have an office here, and any staff that I've been losing from the offices back in the UK, whether that's because they left by their own choice or because they weren't the right people, we're re-recruiting those over here just because I know my life is here to stay in Dubai, and I want to have an office that I can kind of control, because I very much struggle to manage things properly from 3,000 miles away. But in terms of this year, my kind of focus is a bit more on consolidation than growth, not making things smaller, but just putting more effort and time into the businesses that I've already got, because I think something I've been very guilty of over the last few years is just doing more and more new things. And, you know, ultimately, there's only so many hours in the day. You know, my team is only as big as it is. And I think all the businesses that we've got have got fantastic opportunity for growth, and I'm probably stifling that growth and that opportunity because I'm running off, you know, in another direction with another idea, with another shiny object syndrome. So concentrate on the things that we've got, build a strong team here in Dubai, and let's maybe rehave that conversation again in 2025.
I'm looking forward to having that conversation. looking forward to what you do next. Really fascinating. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having
Matt.
Me.
Tune to our show on all podcast platforms. Support your local business, Anghami, or listen to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And stream this episode on smashme.tv if you'd like the video version. Thank you, and see you tomorrow.